If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody. This is the How to Hunt Turkey podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and I have a little bit of an embarrassing story to kick this episode off with.
Cheers to the Red Bull. Shout
exactly. out Red Bull. I don't consume a lot of hunting content. I try to avoid social media at times, which is two really big, like, I don't know, I'd call it a red flag if I didn't vet, like, if I didn't vet someone who doesn't know what they're talking about, or on your case, not knowing the pedigree that you have before getting you on the show. I think this dude just loves to turkey hunt, and that's the truth.
that is the truth.
But there's 100%. A little bit more to your story, Scott Ellis.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay, so we're gonna talk a little bit about that here today, Scott. For those who don't know you, and including myself. Talk to me a little bit about who you are and what do you do for a living?
For a living, I'm an inventory manager. That's okay. The short version of my full-time job.
Yep.
But I moonlight as a competitive turkey caller, and I work for Woodhaven Custom Calls. I'm the pro staff manager. Work for Apex as a brand ambassador, Mossy Oak National Pro Staff, and Thermacell. And I'm from Florida, So you got to have the Thermacells. That's definitely a good connection to have. And I mean, I've been turkey hunting for 40 years and won my share of titles on the stage competitively and learned to hunt turkeys on public ground in Florida, Osceolas on pressured land in Florida. So I've always used that as a precursor to anybody that can do that consistently. They usually can kill Rios, Miriams, and Easterns with a good bit of success. So yeah, that's the Cliff's Notes version of who I am. Yeah.
What got you interested in competitive calling?
Like I was saying before, on public ground, I learned pretty quickly as a young fella, 10, 11 years old, when I started turkey hunting and picked up a mouth call. And the more you sounded like a turkey and the more realistic you were, the more turkeys you could kill. Mm-hmm. And now that goes hand in hand with great woodsmanship, knowing when to shut up, knowing when to get a little fancy if you need to, knowing when to soft call, et cetera. But just having next level realism along with great woodsmanship skills make you what I've always said as a turkey serial killer. You have great callers that aren't great woodsmen that'll kill turkeys, and you have great woodsmen that are great callers, not necessarily competition level callers, but callers that are super proficient in the turkey's vocabulary at a minimum. Great with rhythms. They know the call. They know what the call means and what they're saying to the turkey. You couple that with great woodsmanship skills, and you're going to have a turkey serial killer. And so that's why I took it to the stage after I got real good. I say real good. I mastered the mouth call pretty quickly. I'm somewhat musical. I play guitar. I sing. I can hold a note, somewhat of a note. So it came, you know, the hearing part and the sound part came really easy as far as emulating the sounds I was hearing. So, yeah, that's why I took it to the stage, man, just to be more realistic is what it boiled down to. And then, you know, the competitive spirit as well.
Yeah.
Bragging rights. You know, that's always cool.
Yeah. When you how old were you when you won your first, not national, but first ever competition?
Oh, that's a great question. Short version. We got to go Cliff's Notes here. I was 17 years old in high school. I had $20 to go call in the Florida State Turkey Calling Championships in 1992. It was my senior year of high school.
Okay.
I only had $20. I called the guys that were heading the NWTF chapter that put the Florida State contest on. What is 1992? What is that?
Yeah.
36 years ago? Is that my math? Over 30 years ago.
Right.
And I said, look, I've only got $20. Can I call up in the senior division? Even though I'm at the time 17 and under. Your junior division. There was not an intermediate. There wasn't a Jake's. It was just the juniors.
Okay.
And he chuckled and he goes, sure, son, you can put that $20 anywhere you want to. And, you know, laughed at me and I ended up placing second in the Florida State. Well, I was in college, did a semester of college, joined the Army, served 6 years in the Army, got out and came back to home to Florida in 99 and started competitively calling again, picking it back up because I didn't call. I called in South Carolina when I was a resident of South Carolina. I was at Fort Jackson the last 2.5-3 years of my duty was at Fort Jackson. So I was a South Carolina resident and I called in the state there and I didn't fare very well at all. Really didn't know the ins and the outs of the contest, the game of contest calling. So I came home in 99, started competing again in Florida in 2000. And then in 2004, I won my first Florida State senior division title. I think it was 2004.
Yeah. Okay. And then in order to get to the national stage to compete, do you have to win a state title?
State or open. State or open.
Yep. Okay. Yep. All right. And then when it, and then where is the national title held at? Is that at the convention every year?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Every year at the convention. Yep. Coincides with wherever it's at. It's been in Nashville now for the last almost 20 years. So.
Okay. And then as far as the national tournament is concerned, how many people are in that?
It ranges from 40 to 60.
Yeah. 40 to 60.
Changes. Okay. It ebbs and flows year to year. Yep.
Okay. Now, this is a curiosity to me. Like, an athlete lifts weights and works on their sprints. And if you're in football, we got the Super Bowl coming up. You know, they're watching tape, watching film, stuff like that. How do you practice to get better at turkey and owl calling and all of that stuff?
Listening to the wild turkeys. There's a certain study that can be said and can be argued where you're listening to what is scoring, if you will, like what other guys, they're the group as a whole, the baseline that's created for scoring well is how as far as presentation, how they're putting the calls together. Some things will catch on and there'll be a trend. And then you kind of want to follow along because you don't want to do something completely different than the field's doing, but you want to spice it up, put your own spin on it. And then, you know, once you master a mouth call, it's like being a master guitarist. I mean, once you master it and you know what the call does and the intricacies of the call, and it's just like an instrument. You're rehearsing your set of music almost but you're wanting to keep it wild and keep it real and keep it like a real turkey. But you're very polished. The best are always going to be very polished in control, and they're painting a picture with sound. That's what I always say about competition calling. They're painting a picture with sound, and you want to create that sound in that hen that will score all over with any set of judges, any ears, whether it's Missouri or New York or Florida or wherever. And I used to travel a bunch in my heyday when I was traveling 8 or 10 contests a year, and I'm living in Florida. So the only place I could drive realistically would be Georgia. Maybe South Carolina is going to be the nearest contest, would have been 8-9 hours away. Alabama's a pretty good hike, 8 to 10 hours away, that where the contests were in that era back in the mid-2000s to about 2020, we'll call it. We'll call it 15, 18 years. And I would travel all over the country, and I did very well traveling all over the country. And that sound, that hen that I had in my ear that I started putting to the stage, the realism was there. And there's a hen that I would hear in the woods more common than others. And then I had that hen in my ear, and then I started presenting that hen across the country, and it started being scored very well. And I'm like, well, okay, this is the hen that's the baseline, if you will. You know, it never fell deaf or fell unpleasant on any judge's ears. And that's how, when you found that formula, then you found some success.
Gotcha. Okay. What does a judge look for? Like, are there check boxes that have to be met? Like, I need a yelp, I need a gobble, I need an owl hoot, I need these certain things in every presentation.
There's calls that are set forth before the contest that you have to imitate, whether it's kinky run, cluck and purr, fly down cackle, cutting, excited yelp. There's 8 or 10 calls on that card. Don't ask me to name them all, because I could probably do it if we sit here long enough. But they draw calls out of a cup or out of a hat, and then those calls are listed for the callers, sometimes prior to the contest, sometimes it's the day of the contest, and that way you know which calls you're doing when you get to that contest.
Yeah. Okay. Bodybuilding, there's a period where there's two guys on, maybe it's a showdown or something like that, where they'll have two guys, one will step in front of the other guy and they'll flex, and then the other guy will maybe push him out of the way and he'll flex, and they have this showdown. Is there ever like a sudden victory overtime or a showdown or anything like that goes down?
Let me break it out to you so you can understand the process. The process is 10 callers go in, you draw 11 positions, you put 11 numbers in a hat, okay? Mm-hmm. Number one caller that draws number one gets to call again, because that number one, the lower numbers generally will not get scored as well. It's just the nature of the beast in contest calling, because I think the judges don't want to give away the higher scores because they think somebody else could come along. It's not the way I prefer when I judge. If it's good, I score it a 20 or a 19 out of 20. Yeah. Scores from 1 to 20. Everybody draws their calling order by those numbers, and then you go out. The judges are behind a curtain. They cannot see the caller. You're just a number. You give your fly down cackle, your plain yelp, your cutting, your cluck and purr, your kiki run. Your 4 to 5 calls is usually what they ask for. And then they write down a score from 1 to 20. At the end of the round, or at the end of your, whenever you're done calling, they'll take the scorecards, they'll throw out the high card and the low card. Okay, so five judges minimum is what's really needed. They'll throw the high points and the low points out, and you'll have your middle ground, your median, and then that's what your score is. So that's how it goes down. Now, there was a contest in Nashville that I won 3 times called the head-to-head, and that did have two guys going not at the same time. Caller one calls, caller two calls, and then the judges write down a score. They check who won that round. So it's more of a sudden death type of thing. Then the next call is called. Caller one does his rendition. Caller two does his rendition. And then the 5, 6, 7 judges will go one or two, caller one or two. And then they add up who is the majority winner of that call. And then you go on to the rounds. And it's like the final four bracketing. It's like a bracketing system for basketball is how that worked. You were in these brackets. And the winner would come here. And I think you could lose one round. You can lose once and still be in it. But then you had to beat the guy that went through unbeaten twice at the end if you lost one, but then continue to win. So there you go.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, in like a state fair, my grandpa showed horses, and you got a team of horses, and then you have like all these individual type of moves or formations that also were scored on. So obviously there's the overall presentation, but then is there any like honorable mentions for your Kiki run or your Yelp or anything like that that stands out?
Top three, you'll have the top. Some contests will be top five. Grand Nationals is top five. We'll get a plaque or trophy and some cash. And most local contests, we call them, are top three. Some of the bigger local contests, if you will, or will be top five. There's nothing that stands out for one individual effort, if you will.
Gotcha. Now, what about you mentioned something, I think, before we started recording with owls?
Mm-hmm.
And is that part of... Is that part of the turkey calling contest?
Absolutely. It's own division, owl hooting locating division. Okay. Yep, just for locating. Okay. And they started doing it in the 70s at the NWTF convention and the Grand Nationals. And I'm surprised they never did a crow, to be honest with you. That's something I've always entertained is doing a crow division as well. But the owl's just been carried on and on. And it's just the best that can hoot. I've actually got an owl. This is the one I designed with Woodhaven. This is called the Ninja Owl. I designed this call. Sell them, get them at Bass Pros. You can get them at Cabela's, www.woodhavencustomcalls.com, all the big box stores. But yeah, this is an owl hooter. It's a reed style owl hooter. And this is something what we blow. Most everybody blows a reed style hooter. I'll run it for you. So there's a barred owl, and that's what it'll do. Just a quick version of what it do on the stage. And obviously you don't do all that when you're locating with it. You don't run that all together, but you have one minute to compete in the owl division. 1 minute to paint a picture of a barred owl as best you can.
That's pretty sweet.
Now, you look intrigued.
To a guy. Yeah. I mean, so I'm envisioning a judge from behind the curtain. Have you ever had to judge a contest before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, love judging.
Yeah, okay. So I'm envisioning a guy who can't see it, and I would envision closing my eyes and trying to, like, put the scenario that I possibly have heard before sitting against a tree as the sun's coming up, right? Like, and this is a... This was for some reason, the video that came across my internet or my social media feed was a kid doing this, but he started off with the owl hoot, and then it turned into a shot gobble, and then that he had a wing with him and he flapped it and it sounded like fly down, and then he had a box of leaves that he had brought on stage for scratching, which turned into a hen yelping, which turned into another gobble, and then all these things. And like, I can envision myself hearing that exact same thing in the woods. So is the presentation as a whole scored on, or just the little calls themselves?
No, it's how you present it. You don't just go yelp, 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 yelp. You know, you present it. You envision you're a hen on that stage walking around, plain yelping or clucking and purring. So you have to present it. You have to paint the picture of a hen turkey actually doing the call in the woods, and you only have a minute per call. So you have to cram a lot. You don't want to be rushed, but you don't want to be too slow. So you have to give them enough, and you have to not give them too much, you know, where you get too rushed in the sequence. So that's what you're doing. Yeah,
man.
And then at the end of the day, you have to make the realization it is 1 minute that a guy's trying to paint a picture of a turkey on a stage, not necessarily how a hen yelps in the woods, walking through the woods. You follow me? You're trying to cram a lot into 1 minute and still paint a picture and still make it realistic. And some of the sequences are very realistic to what I've heard hens do in the wild when we do cutting sequences, when we do kiki runs. Some of them, a fly down cackle is pretty straightforward. Plain yelping, there's a lot more yelping than you will generally hear a hen do when she's just walking through the woods, unless she's a little, you know, tuned up. She's got a little bit of excitement, but we're doing as much as we can do in 1 minute to paint a picture with sound, like I said earlier.
Okay. Now, going back to 40 years of hunting high-pressured public land in Florida, when I hear the word high pressure, I think of quiet birds. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't think of a lot of noise being made by them, right, because maybe right. they've been published a lot or pressured a lot.
Pressured. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about how you've generated these calling sequences through real life hunting in high pressured scenarios.
Absolutely. Pretty quickly in Florida. Now, Osceolas are what I call a less flamboyant version of an Easter. As okay. a rule of thumb, as a whole, Osceolas tend to gobble a little less. Now, there's always exceptions to every rule. It's turkeys. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got to caveat everything with that. But as a whole, after hunting them 40 years there, they gobble generally a little less. The areas that you hunt them, unless you're lucky enough to hunt on pressured areas, if you're hunting public ground, I mean, and now more than ever are people coming to Florida trying to circumvent $4,000 Osceola fees for outfitters. I mean, it's getting ridiculous down here. So yeah, the pressure, the hunting pressure, the human contact is what gets them, like you said, to quiet down. And what I have learned to do very early on is the soft stuff, the clucks and purrs, the whines, the muted yelps, not being super loud and aggressive. I love to cut an excited yelp one to death if I can do it. But more often than not, if you're hunting public ground in Florida, you're going to have to reel that back considerably. Scratching in the leaves, using a wing to fly down, but not making a cackle, but just doing a fly down with a couple tree calls, but not being flamboyant. And then doing the full all the way to the ground. You know, you just use the wing and slap that wing on your arm, because I carry two wings with me to stage fights and to do fly downs and whatnot. And so turkey noises incorporated with some light turkey sounds always bodes very well on public ground on pressured birds.
Okay. Now, do you feel that because you are a better, like you've practiced and you've taken your calling to the next level beyond the average hunter, that has actually, the realism in that has actually allowed you to trick hens or toms to bring them in closer because of the realism?
100%. I mean, some will argue that, but in my mind, and I've killed quite a few of these crazy birds in a lot of places, about 28 states I've hunted. And yes, the realism, when you're in competition with other hunters and you can do those softer, more realistic sequences, it makes a difference. I don't care what anybody says, it makes a difference, 100%. And to take it one step further, we were chatting before we actually started recording about the competition calling, incorporating it into your hunting sequences. And the really cool thing about when you master one of these and you truly learn their language, if you can caveat that with learning their language, and when you're clucking and purring, knowing that you're contented and you're calming them down, or if you're cutting, you're bringing his emotion up and getting him excited. If you know what you're trying to say and how you're capitalizing on his emotions, that's what's going to end up killing turkeys. And the ability to master a mouth call or even a pot call, if it's friction calls, nothing wrong with that. If it's a pot call, style call or even a box call, when you can produce any of those calls on demand without worrying about being nervous, or we've probably all been there. I get cottonmouth a lot. When I got a bird working in, I'll get cottonmouth and I'm still getting excited as I did 40 years ago. So clucking and purring can become a little bit of a challenge, but what it does do when you've mastered it is, you know, you got the color of your mouth and when you can do that on demand when you need to do it. You know, it's second nature. You can produce that call just like an instrument. And as opposed to guys that aren't as confident and aren't as proficient in their calling, I remember early on when I was a kid, I would be like, oh, I'm going to try to make this cluck and make this sound good, you know, and you were trying to get it out. When you master the call, even if you don't take it to competition level, if you just really master it, it's great to be able to produce the calls and do it on demand under pressure, under the gun.
Yeah. Okay. So with that said, then, high pressure ground, quiet birds, spooked birds, you know, they're every season, it seems like they get more intelligent about their surroundings. Mm-hmm. How do you then go in and try to call, like, talk to me a little bit about the process of calling to pressured birds?
Well, we'd have to discuss two different scenarios. One is if you happen to get one to gobble.
Yeah,
in public ground, on pressure ground, even we can even open this wider and call it even hunting pressure on like leases. There's pressure can be on private. Any, we'll just call it pressure necessarily versus just public. Public obviously is going to get worse pressure than anywhere, but just anywhere where they're pressured and they may, and it may influence them in how much they talk. I go into an area. If he happens to gobble, that's a bonus. If it's a pressured area, when I get him, when I've located him, I try to slip into him as tight as I can get in there to him. And if I know that area that I'm hunting, once I've deduced that area is pressured and it, you know, it's late season or whatever, then I'm going to try to get his attention as quick as I can, as softly as I can, and try not to make him gobble, make him gobble as little as I possibly can. I don't want him to advertise what he's doing, obviously, because people will be coming in on you like ants on a honey bun. You know what I mean? You got to, once you have located him and you can engage him with some tree calls, just some soft yelps and bubble clucks, and just tree call him a little bit and let him know you're there, and then wait till he flies down. And then two, the other problem with, if he does sit out there and gobble and he doesn't gobble up people, he'll gobble up hens. So that's the first thing that I start off with doing. If it's a bird I happen to get off the roost, you know, it's a morning, at daybreak hunt. If it's on into the morning and I may be slipping and calling, I don't use the term running and gunning, especially on public land. I slip and call. You know, I'll cover salt ground with softer yelps, not getting too excited, not bringing too much attention to myself, but yet trying to elicit a response. And on top of that, I also will use locators heavily if I can when I'm hunting that pressured land. I use a crow call. Woodhaven has a new hawk call coming out. It's called the Ninja Hawk, and we have a crow call. On top of the owl, you can use the owl as well. Sorry, I dropped a mouth call over here. And but a crow call, is it okay to run these things, or am I blowing the mic out? Are we blowing it out?
I don't know yet, so go ahead and.
So I use a crow call a lot to try to get one to gobble. You know, just getting aggressive, doing the basic call, and then throwing some throat into it and something like that.
Yep.
Just to get the rashes, the raucousness, if you will. And the hawk call is a great one. This will do a pileated woodpecker, a hawk call, and a peacock. But you do your pileated woodpecker, and then you can do the red shouldered hawk. Great locator, and then you can just slow it down, very similar, and do a peacock. So high shrill sound. Great call, easy to use. You just blow air. You just find the rhythm and blow a little air to it. So I rely heavily, if I can, to get one to gobble on locators before we throw in a mouth call or get a pot call out. Yeah. And if you strike one, you strike one. You sat down on him. Again, less is more. Then pressure turkeys, whether they're Rios, Miriams, Easterns, Osceolas, in my opinion. I mean, Miriams could be a little bit different and a little more finicky as well as Rios, because you can call to them a lot more than Easterns and Osceolas. But pressured is pressured. Now, if nothing is gobbling and I'm just in a place I know holds turkeys, I've got sign, I know they're there, I've heard them there before, I know that it holds birds, but they're just not talking, that's where you go back to your competition stuff and the clucks and the purrs and the whines and those little soft yelps I was just doing, scratching in the leaves. And I'll just set in an area, and a lot of people, I'm not deer hunting a turkey. Patience kills a lot of turkeys, man. If you can put those legs down and put your butt down and get comfortable and just do those type sequences, the soft stuff with scratching in the leaves and maybe a little louder yelp. I just wouldn't go in there yelling and screaming, cutting and cackling and carrying on and being real loud and aggressive. I'd keep it toned down and maybe some mid-level plain yelps mixed in with the other stuff, just so turkey's hearing is four times better than ours, but just so that they can hear it a little bit further and reach a little bit further. And I think that covers about, you know, the gamut for pressure turkeys off the roost midday. And then if you're not hearing anything and you're trying to set up and blind call one.
Yeah. I just envisioned myself hunting with you and then me trying to call and you slapping the call right out of my mouth.
There's some funny TikTok stuff going on with that right now. I've seen something about that where somebody's put your calls away, you know, that kind of deal.
Yeah. One of the first times, I tell the story a lot, but, I bought a mouth call and I was practicing in my truck and trying to get it, you know, doing it the right way. And I pull up to turkey camp with my uncle and I started practicing. He just looks at me and goes, "Why don't you let me take care of that?" And I just,
I got it.
I did not have I did not have the skill set quite yet to where that needed to be.
But it's great to go with somebody. That's always something to share. Oh, yeah. If you can find somebody that's seasoned, that's been doing it a while, that can teach you the ropes, that is definitely a way to go. I stumbled around I killed a bird killed two birds the first season I ever hunted. So I was a sponge. Short version. I love doing the short versions because I have to tell myself to not get too long winded. But this was right on the cusp of the All Stars of Spring VHS that you're talking about, the Truth series with Primos, all of that. It was a few years before that even hit. I was just reading every article that I could put. Field and Stream, Peterson's Hunting, any magazine that had an article. Because I was a cool spinoff is I was duck hunting and blowing duck calls before I ever picked up a turkey call. Yep, about 2 years before I started turkey calling. So I was picking up the sounds and learning to run the calls pretty successfully, pretty quickly. So, but if you can get with somebody and not have to stumble around for a couple of years until you figure out how to do it. And once I say I did kill two turkeys the first year I hunted, I made so many mistakes going forward after that. You know, you get that luck behind you, that beginner's luck, so to speak. And then, oh, I know what I'm doing now. And then they start humbling you very quickly. The turkeys will humble you. But I stumbled around doing a lot of different tactics, a lot of different ways, and continue to do so. I'm still a student of the wild turkey, is what I like to say, and continue to learn and continue to make mistakes. But as long as you have a playbook, this is what I always say. If you've got a playbook with about 200 pages of plays in them, you've always got options, then you can deploy those. You can run those plays. If that play doesn't work, try this play or this tactic, if you will. Have a tactic book, a playbook. And that's what always will separate great turkey hunters from mediocre turkey hunters. The guy that just sits there on a box call and clucks and yelps and clucks and yelps all day, and that's all he knows to do. He doesn't know to do fighting purrs, to reposition, to get in front of birds that are moving and traveling, or do a fighting purr or gobble at him or whatever. There's just so many things. You have to have that playbook and exhaust every one of them, because something's bound to work at some point. Don't be afraid to use those tactics and those methods. He either comes in or he doesn't, right? I mean.
Right. Right.
One thing, you don't start that process until you've got to the point where he's not closing anymore. So you have to start trying something else, or you just sit there. So sorry.
Exactly. Go ahead. No, you're fine. You're fine. I forgot to do my advertisement partners. Thank you to my partners. So just real quick here, so I can check it off here, is if you're looking for a turkey decoy, go check out MontanaDecoy.com. I really like these decoys because they are collapsible. They're print, like they have high definition printing on them, and you can throw them in a backpack. You can beat the crap out of them. They pop straight up, and you can get them out and run it again. And we'll talk about decoys here in a second, in a little bit. But if you want to go find out more information of all the decoys that they offer, go check out MontanaDecoy.com. Now, there's a lot of people out there who are not at your level, and are, maybe I'll put them at the weekend warrior, right? They're not crazy about it. I mean, I'm right there. Right. Like I'm a deer hunter for the most part, who loves to turkey hunt as the second type thing. Right. And bring the kids out. I know for a fact that I call too loud and I call too much. What would you tell me to do differently? And as far as maybe the, you know, calling too loud and calling too often, is there a backup plan that I can throw into place? 'Cause you mentioned the playbooks.
Right. You always have to throw the different time of day. Are you running and gunning? Are you blind calling? Is it off the roost hunt in the morning? So there's those kind of the three categories that I try to talk about when we're addressing these type of situations. The biggest thing is, if you think you're calling too much, you're probably calling too much.
We're
all there to hear him gobble, but only call that turkey enough to keep him moving to you, and then to check him once in a blue moon as he started. If you feel him closing, you don't have to keep calling just to get him to gobble. If you're hearing him progress towards you, the more you call, the more chances are he's going to hang up on you and get stubborn and want you to go to him and do your thing. And he's going to stand there and be flamboyant and show out and be the big man on the block. And so less is more. Caveat to that would be Miriam's and Rio's. You can call more and more aggressively to both of those birds. I've always made the joke that they both have ADD. Miriam's worse than Rio's. They both have ADD, and they are, they're open to a lot more conversation than Eastern's Osceolas, without a doubt. You can call to them more. I've actually to a fault, not caught enough. I've been hunting Miriams and Rios for probably about 20 years now, about 18 years. And early on, to a fault, I would not call enough because I'm so used to calling more sparingly. Even though I can make all the calls, I'm very good. I like to shut it down. I like to play coy, cat and mouse, if you will, and only elevate the advanced level calling if I need to, cutting and, you know, kiki runs and just whatever. But Rios and Miriams, I've, to a fault, not called enough, and they'll walk off and leave you. They'll lose interest and just go, I'll just find the next hot thing. So that's the one caveat to the not calling. You need to go hunt Miriams. If you like to call loud and a lot, go to hunt Miriams. You'll have a blast. So where are you out of, Dan?
I live in eastern Iowa.
Okay. So you're up there in eastern country. Okay. Gotcha.
Yep.
And so, just try to scale it back a little bit and only call enough to that bird to keep him moving to your location. Don't wait too long. It's a feel thing. You know what I mean? You'll learn it. I feel people learn it the more they do it, but, just give him enough to keep his forward progression. If he kind of stalls on you, get a little more excited. If that little more excitement level doesn't get him to break and start closing again, start calming it down, start clucking and purring, go the other direction, like play coy with him and shy. If that doesn't work, then I will probably just shut up and stop calling and make him really try to figure out what's going on. I've heard this sexy girl over there for the last 15, 20 minutes, and now she's not even there talking to me anymore. That will get him. That'll get the best of him a lot of times. So that's okay.
That was going to be my next question is, because a lot of times, I mean, I went on a killing spree there for a while where I got him, and call it luck. But I got them right off the roost. They fly down, they close 50 to, you know, 100 yards, boom, dead. Mm-hmm. Let's go eat breakfast.
You got to love those.
exactly. And then some things shifted. They went through and logged some trees on the property. And now they're in different spots which have different terrain features and different access routes to get into there. And now I'm finding that I can get them in to this 100-yard mark, 75-yard mark, and then I can even see them. Mm-hmm. But I can't get them to close the distance, even like horned up Jakes, right? Like 2-year-olds, you know, those types of deal. Is there a specific scenario like that in a calling sequence that I should think about?
First off, are you running decoys with these birds hanging up there 100 yards?
Sometimes I am, sometimes I am not. And if I do run decoys, the decoys are usually behind me an additional 50 to 70 yards.
That's a good tactic. And they're still hanging out there.
Still hanging out.
I just would... So they've got a visual. First thing is, if you do run deeks, they've got a visual. That's a great tactic to put them behind you like that. So if they cut the distance, if they're 100 and they cut the distance 50 and the decoys to the deeks, then they're behind you and they're going to be in gun range. So you're probably overcalling them. I mean, you said it, you call too much and too loud. You probably just need to go quiet. Now, there's a whole nother podcast to be said about watching birds that you're calling to and watching his body language. And seeing if he's just spinning in a circle, figurating, and he's just not showing, he's not just coming to you. He's displaying, he's showing out. That's when I'm immediately going to shut it down and start calling less. I mean, when you see him in that holding pattern, you got to shut up. I mean, now what I would do in certain situations, I carry two wings. I wish I had them. I could demonstrate it. It's on my show, Hunt Quest, on YouTube. There's a video of it. I think it has me, the side camera has me, I'm beating these wings that I'm fighting for. And I'm beating the wings all over me. And they're hearing the wing slaps and they're hearing the fighting purrs. And they're going, whoa, who is over here fighting? I'm the man right here. Who are these two gobblers coming in on my area fighting over girls that I should have? That's something that will break them and work. So that's something that'll work. You can gobble at them, challenge them. Shut it down, gobble at them, fighting purrs. You obviously are pinned down. You can't reposition on these turkeys because they're in the open, correct? You're on clear cuts. Yeah, that's tough. You can't do anything but sit there. Try to pattern them. You know, watch where they're going. If there's any pattern whatsoever where they're hanging in that strut zone right when they fly down, if they're consistently doing that, move your blind or build you a little brush blind near that area where his strut zone is, where he's flying down and moving. If it's just random places, on the property, then that makes it harder. But you can pattern them just like a deer to, and a lot of times they will do that. The other thing that I want to talk about is how many trees do you have when you say that you're probably on the edge of woods on clear cuts? Is that what you're doing, would you say?
I'm farm country, right? So It's picked corn, picked beans, and then, I don't know, into a big terrain feature like a big drainage or a river bottom or something like that. And there's oak trees or big oak trees or cottonwoods or something like that, that like, they're roosting in. Yeah.
So there's,
but it's like a timbered fingers
wide open.
Or in the timber, parts of it are, and parts of it can be thick as well.
Well, the spin I was going to get into is my tactic of not running decoys, and I do what's called hiding the hen. And it's something I came up with about 15 years ago, the terminology hiding the hen, because I don't run deeks. When I set up on a turkey, or I'm setting up blind calling and just no engagement, I'm just setting up in an area and doing some calling to try to lure one in. I do what's called hiding the hen. And hiding the hen is using terrain features, roads, bends in roads, elevation changes, pinch points. I'm putting myself in a place where a gobbler cannot see me from long distances. He has to close. If he wants to make any kind of a play on this old sexy girl he's hearing, he has to come in close to you or closer to you to make contact. And when you're in an open field environment like that and you're 20 yards inside the wood line instead of in on the, don't get on the wood edge, even with deeks. I mean, get in the woods 20 yards where he can look over there, but he cannot see the hen he's hearing. And that's called hiding the hen. And that can be the game. I set up on the bend of a road and I hear that bird gobbling and I know he's in the road. You can just tell he's walking the road. And I get on that bend in the road and I put where that bend is about 30 yards from me. So, or even 40-ish. And that way, when he comes, as soon as he comes around that corner to go, where is she? Boom, I shoot him in the face. And if you'll watch my show, Hunt Quest, on YouTube, you'll see me not running deeks. You'll see a lot of my kill shots, if you will, the shots are on birds that just slip in there and they're on top of you and their head comes up and you identify it's a long beard and boom, you get shot. So just because of that very reason, that's how you set up. There's not a bunch of B-roll humping decoys and fighting decoys and all that.
Right.
It's in the woods. It's using cover. It's using roads. It's using road beds, elevation changes to hide that hen. And then when he comes in, and quite often he'll come in and go, uh-oh, where's the hen? And it's too late. Like he'll come in to look for that hen and he cannot see her. He says, there should be a hen here, but it's too late. He's in gun range.
Yeah.
So that's something I've been using for years and years and years and years and years. Just named it about 15 years ago, hide the hen, but I've been setting up that way. I experimented with decoys in the early 90s, mid 90s, when the old Feather Flex came out, the foam, ugly foam decoys.
Yep.
Had some mixed results with them, but more times than not, they would stand out there and lock up on that decoy and look at it at 75 yards and then walk off. Don't ask me why. They just would not close. And it had I not had all those bad experiences, because this was about 10 years into me turkey hunting when these deeks hit the market. Okay.
Right.
Had I not had that experience, I might be a diehard decoy user to this day, but I had bad experiences early on and that changed my whole, and I'd already learned to hunt them without decoys anyways. Okay. So when they were introduced, I said, well, I got to try this. This is a no brainer. Look how ducks decoy to decoys. Look how they work to decoys. And this is going to be like shooting fish in a barrel, you know. And then I had more negative than positive enough to say, I gave the decoys away and went right back to what I've been doing for about a decade of hunting them and hiding the hen. Yeah.
Okay. So here's another scenario. I think a lot of guys, especially the further east you go, you know, obviously there's the public land, but then there's access on smaller pieces of property where maybe they're cornered, and if you be aggressive, they're going to pop onto the neighbors, or they're going to pop off public into another piece of private. What's your tactic when the term "hend up" pops up, and maybe you can see him, you know he's gobbling, he's reacting to you, but he's hend up.
It's a great question. I'll tell you, you're asking all the right questions. You're asking questions about stuff I love to ramble on about. Yeah. I've been using this TikTok thing quite a bit, and I'm having a lot of fun doing instructionals and tips and stuff on TikTok and getting a lot of engagement. And I just did a video on talking to the hens, calling to the hens when you have identified that gobbler has hens. And I'll give you my quick dissertation of it. When you know he's got hens and he's just not going to break from them, you have to revert to trying to have a civil conversation with the hens. The flock, the harem, we'll have a boss hen. She's established mm-hmm. some kind of dominance, whether it's her and a bunch of jennies, because jennies will breed, or if it's mm-hmm. just her and a bunch of older hens, mature hens. Somehow, some way, she was the boss hen. She established dominance, okay? But that doesn't mean she's always going to be the aggressive dominant. She's not going to be the confrontational type hen. So usually that hen, the boss hen of that harem, will have one of two personality traits. She'll be kind of coy and passive and stubborn and not wanting to be confrontational. Or she's that hen that you probably have encountered that everybody loves that mm-hmm. just starts cutting. As soon as you make a sound, she's pissed off. She starts cutting. Then you start cutting. She'll bring the whole flock over, gobbler in tow, and you shoot the gobbler in the face. So, but what I encourage everybody to do when you've identified he has hens is don't start off too aggressive. Start off with a civil. You don't want to meet somebody and go, "What's up, Dan? I'm going to kick your butt." You know, you don't want to start a conversation like that. And that's what you're doing if you just start hearing a hen or knowing he's got hens, and you start cutting and challenging her and been trying to establish dominance over her. If she's that other personality, the coy, passive, and not the dominant style personality, she's just going to walk away. You've seen it a million times. It'll push the hens away. They're like, no, I don't want nothing to do with this. So if you start that conversation and that engagement with just some clucks and some yelps, say, "Hello, how are you doing?" I mean, I'll demonstrate it here. Just basic civil greeting. "How are you doing?" Just cluck and yelp to her. Just say, "Hello, how are you?" And there's nothing aggressive. That's just a basic contact call for a hen to say, "Hey, what's going on? How are you?" I hate wearing headphones and trying to call. I can't hear my call. But, then, you know, plain yelps and clucks. Now, if that doesn't work, before you escalate, try kiki run. Sometimes that boss hen is a brood hen, was a brood hen in the prior fall. And you start keying, a lot of times she'll come investigate a jenny that's keying, or another hen that's keying, like they're looking for company. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't work, then why not go ahead and try to get aggressive and try to get her fired up. If she's that confrontational personality trait, then she may get pissed off, start cutting. She'll start cutting. You start cutting. She starts hammering back at you. You guys get into a pissing match, and then she brings the gobbler over to you. But oftentimes, if you're just civil and non-confrontational, they'll just wander over to you because they're not feeling disturbed. They're not feeling they have to get into an altercation. They'll just wander over to see who the newcomer is on the block. So just keep that in mind when you're calling to those hens. Start civil and only escalate that calling and that aggressiveness if the civil stuff isn't working. There's nothing wrong with trying to escalate it. But a lot of times, like I said, they'll just wander over. "Well, who's this?" You know, cluck and purr, do some plain yelps. And just talk to her, just have a nice conversation. Like you're looking for company. You're wanting company, not that you're wanting to fight.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, escalate it. Yeah.
So it sounds to me like obviously there is a pattern or vocalizations where you're talking to the Tom. And then there's also the same or not the same, but a different quote unquote playbook that you would throw at hens mm-hmm. when the calls you're making to the Tom aren't working.
Right. Yep.
Okay.
Just like I explained to the hens, you got to figure when you're just talking to a gobbler, you're trying to sex him up, if you will. You're trying to fire him up, get him excited to come look for you. If that doesn't work, and that's going to be with just basic stuff, it's all about exploiting his emotions and capitalizing and trying to change his mood or tweak his mood to make him say, "Oh, I got to go check this girl out."
Yep.
Whether it's getting excited, whether it's getting soft and coy, you're using those, the clucks and purrs for soft and coy, the plain yelps for middle of the road, excited yelps and cutting to really escalate the excitement level and getting fired up. Then there's gobbler yelps and jake yelps, and there's fighting purrs and there's gobbling. And that's when you're using gobbler talk to challenge him when the hen calls aren't working. So you can challenge the hens or have civil conversations with the hens. You can have civil conversation, a sexy civil conversation, we'll call it, with a gobbler. If that don't work, then you can challenge him by imitating a male turkey, another gobbler.
Okay.
That's the crash course in it, I think.
How does your calling change through the months? Like March and April to mid-April to April, May, and so on. How does it change?
Short answer, it doesn't based on time. It's based what you were talking about when we first started, pressure. because I've hunted places I knew were not pressured late in the season and just wore them out, called like I was the opening day of season. So everything I do, I try to get the best feel I can on how much these turkeys have been harassed by people. Yeah.
Okay. So right. And that dictates your calling sequence.
100%. 100%. Gotcha. Because, I mean, you could go into the nesting phases, the breeding phases, gathering hens, with hens, breeding hens. Hens start leaving to lay, hens start leaving the nest. Okay, so that was just a quick version of it. And you can adjust your calling a little bit to that by being maybe more aggressive when you know they're actively looking. If the hens are starting to nest and set, then the birds are going to be like bucks after not post rut, but almost like the secondary rut. They're going to be on their feet looking, cruising for does they missed. Gobblers do the same thing. Once they bred their harem, they're going to start roaming around, and they're going to be quite susceptible to a call because they're trying to find the last ones that haven't been bred. So then you can escalate your calling and be a little more aggressive. But again, that's all the phases are different in different parts of the same state you're in. Sometimes, you know, it doesn't hold true. That could be a week in front or behind of where it was 50 miles east or west. It's spring. Spring covers a pretty broad area. It's not like the rut that's, you know, early November to mid to late November and in between, minus their secondary ruts. So it's a bigger window. And so a lot more can go on in the vicinity that you're, the region even that you're hunting. You know, I've seen them where they were, these hens are nesting and these hens over here in this wad of this group, they're still actively breeding. So,
How does your calling change in environmental change? Like South Dakota, Merriam's, it's wide open out there in, in certain areas, right? It's like less terrain, more like timbered
draws
and drainages. Ridges. Yeah. Aside from East Coast, big timber, mountainous type environments.
Not a lot changes. I mean, you control your volume based on your emotion level, what you're trying to say to the bird, period. So, I mean, I would say you could call louder in the big prairie type places that are wide open, prairie type environment with little draws, you know, the Badlands of Nebraska. You could call a little louder just to reach further distances because he could be in that draw that's 1,000 yards away. Excuse me. And I got water over here too. And you may want to call louder and try to reach him when calling at a normal level might not. And what I do to circumvent that is I carry a tube call. I did not put a tube call here with me. Have you ever heard of a tube call?
I have, yes.
Okay. I don't go anywhere without a tube call. And so it's great for, it's very, very loud. It's very resonant and it reaches further than about any call that I've ever ran in the woods or in the fields or in the prairies or whatever. And so, yeah, the more open the terrain, when you're trying to carry some distances, I would escalate, you know, raise my volume up a little bit. In big timber, you know, you have the good echo effect. The sound seems to carry and bounce off the trees a little bit. So I'm calling at more of a normal level, like a hen would call, but hens call, they yelp loud and they yelp soft. So, I mean, you know, whatever her motion level is usually what dictates her rhythm and her volume is what, if she's really excited or she's just content and calm.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Last scenario I want to throw out here. And this seems to happen a lot every year, especially now that I've started taking my kids with me. And that is we go in to try to get them off the roost. That don't work. We go in, grab a breakfast at grandma's house, and then we head back out. And when we head back out, they're in the middle of the field, strutting, sometimes with hens, sometimes without. And in this scenario, I'm going to say no hens, because this was what happened last year. No hens, and he's in the middle of the field by himself. We sneak up to the timber line, and we sit down, and we start calling at him a little bit. What's that scenario look like for you?
How did that particular bird act? Were you cutting and yelping? Were you cutting and yelping? And he just did he gobble?
He did gobble a couple times, and this was at like.
So he was in a strut zone.
Yeah, I'm guessing. Yeah,
he was not moving, traveling.
Nope, he big circles. Yep.
He was out there trying to gobble up any hens that could see him from. He's out there displaying in that open area, so that hen could see him from a half a mile away or further, and potentially hear him in that big in the open terrain. And he's in his spot. So you're kind of handcuffed because you can't get there. So the thing would be to skip breakfast and go immediately to that spot where you've seen him before and wait for him. I mean, I'm being honest. We're being honest here.
I know. I'll so tell my boy that.
Yeah, he's probably not going to want to hear that. But
no
I
pancakes
don't
this
that.
Morning, buddy.
I love some breakfast and, or killing one early, like you said, and head to breakfast.
Yep.
You can't move on him, so there's that.
Don't chew on that, Max.
Cooper loves that chew, too.
Oh, now he's into Cooper's food. Wow, he is loving it. What do you feed Cooper?
Blue Buffalo Life Protection Formula. He never leaves a crumb. I love it because it's made with high-quality protein, nutrient-rich fruits and veggies, and wholesome whole grains.
Looks like we're switching to Blue.
Blue Buffalo foods are made with the superior ingredients your dog needs to thrive. Can your dog food say that? Visit feedbluefood.com to learn more.
Then you're going to revert to gobbling at him, fighting purrs. Mm-hmm. After that, watch what he does when he eventually exits the field or the clear cut or farm field that he's in his little strut zone. And you, at that point, try to put eyes on him on, even if you're a weekend warrior, you know, try to, within those 2 days, you're probably hunting him Saturday and Sunday. If he's doing that both times, you go back to what I'm saying. You just need to get there before he does and set up on him. As far as calling him magically, calling him out of that field, Dan, I mean, I've done it. You know, you just hit that right nerve. You change calls. Mm-hmm. Sound like a different hen. Go from a box to a pot to a mouth call. Change the voice on your mouth call. If you're versatile enough to run different voices on your mouth call, go to a trumpet call, wing bone. Just there's nothing wrong with at least trying different hens that he may or may not have heard. If you've been throwing one thing at him that's not working, try throwing a different hen voice at him. But I mean, to say, have I just called him magically out of a field like that? Like, wow, I'm the man. Yeah. You know, it's great for your ego, but I mean, quite honestly, you don't know exactly why he just decided he wanted to come find you. I would definitely go back to hiding the hen. Don't get on that timber edge too close to it. Get further in. So he has to really, because if you get his attention and if you're on the edge, but you're not bumping him, you're hid well enough, but you're on the edge where he probably thinks he can see a hen standing there and he can't, then he's not going to budge. If you stay back in those woods 30, 40 yards as you're sneaking in and then try to call, watch his reaction. You might see him start popping out of strut, craning his neck. If you see that, you've got his interest and he's trying to figure out where you're at. So just watch their body language. Like I said earlier, that's a whole other podcast when you're working a turkey and you can watch his body language and how he's reacting to the calls. It's a beautiful thing because it'll dictate how much that you should call or you should not call it just by him trying to you're getting him to break and he's trying to kind of edge your way and he's looking and he can't figure out where you're at. And then you shut up completely and then he's getting more antsy because he's like, where are you at? Or you just cut real loud to him and you get his attention immediately. And he just says, oh, I got to have some of that. And you sound sexy and you sound realistic if you've taken your calling another notch. That's where that realism, again, there's no magic call, but when you can cut really loud and excited, like I was just doing for you, I mean, when you can do that and throw it in with some yelping and really excite that gobbler and try to change his mood, you can sometimes get him to do things they may not have done if you're just yelping at him, yapping on him with a box call. Yep.
Right. Okay. Do you ever go out and try to roost birds?
You know, not much.
Not much.
Quite honestly, with the way I have to travel when I hunt, I'm other than Georgia and South Carolina, I'm flying. I'm flying to Kansas, Nebraska, New York. Maybe even Washington this year. There's just no, I mean, you're hunting hard as you can. Now, you may try to roost while you're out. If you're in the afternoon, you can hunt in the afternoon. In New York, you cannot. Mm-hmm. We have gone out and tried to roost birds when I hunt New York with my buddy every year. But as a rule of thumb, I mean, southeastern easterns do not gobble very well. They will and they won't. It's very inconsistent when they fly up to roost in the evening. Sometimes they'll burn it down. A lot of times you won't hear anything. You'll go back to that same spot and you'll hear three birds the next morning. I've seen it time and time. Osceolas are worse than Easterns. Yeah. Can you get one to gobble an evening? Absolutely. You can. Does it more times than not, do they not say a word and you go out the next morning to that same spot? You know, there's turkeys and you'll hear multiple gobblers or at least hear that bird more often than not. That's what happens. Miriams and Rios. If you have the time and you have the luxury of getting out in the evenings, they gobble at anything a lot. I love Miriams and Rios, man. And I will say this, the further north you go, and as you start going west to the line of demarcation for Rios and Easterns in Kansas and Oklahoma and Texas, the more southern easterns are far less, to me, are less roostable. But the further north you go, I've hunted Wisconsin and I've hunted Ohio and I've hunted Michigan. The further north you go, the more those old easterns will sound off. You tell me your experience in Iowa. I mean, the further north I've been in hunting them, they will gobble a lot better when they fly up to roost than they will down here. A lot of it, I think, has to do with how hot it gets in the south. Yeah. And the birds are just done. You know, they're out in 85, 90 degree heat sometimes in right. Central Florida, Georgia, South Carolina. You know, early mid-season, it can be 80s. And those birds are yeah. doing their thing all day. By the time they get on the roost that night, they're just ready to shut it down and go to bed. Now, yeah. you got great temps where you have highs in the 60s and 50s as you go north. The birds aren't as exhausted, in my opinion. They're pretty excited and pretty frisky even when they fly up in the evenings. They just tend to gobble. What is your experience, honestly, with the Iowa birds? I have not hunted Iowa yet. Do they gobble enough to roost?
So I'll say this. I haven't really done a lot of roosting just because of, like, jobs and just life.
Baseball games.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But I will say this, that when I've started, just because it's something to do with my boy, go out in a parking lot, shut the truck off, wait mm-hmm. for 40 minutes, and maybe throw a calling sequence out to try to mm-hmm. get him to gobble. And I've had some okay, it's probably 50-50, if not mm-hmm. less.
Right. That's better than getting, the south.
Yeah, at least one to gobble so I know what direction to possibly head in the morning. Right. Or at least knowing that there's a turkey roosting in this tree or going in that area.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a good place to start off in the morning.
Heck,
you know
yeah.
what I mean?
So, oh, it's yeah. a beautiful thing when it happens. It's amazing. Yeah. And you know, you can slide in there and know that there's a bird in that area. You've got him fairly pinpoint, especially with all the Onyx and the maps and everything we have now that we can almost zero in on within 100-yard radius where he's at. But and that's where I do try to provoke a gobble out of one. I'll get my Ninja Owl and I will scream on it. You know, this mm-hmm. thing will barred owl scream. It's a great high pitched climbing call that the barred owl does. And it's yep. and you can then coyote howl on an owl hooter. You can bark on these things like a coyote. You can go back to an owl hoot. And crow calls are great. And then I'll do a fly-up cackle sometimes just to get one to respond. So mm-hmm. When you do go roosting, definitely let it all hang out. Like try to get, provoke a gobble out of one.
Yeah.
Scream on your hooter if it'll scream. Coyote howls up north are a lot more common. I don't do as much in the south because they're just not, the coyotes are everywhere, but not, they don't live in harmony as much as they do. If harmony is the right word.
Yeah.
There's just a lot more coyotes up in the north parts of the United States than there are. We have a bunch of them. Don't get me wrong. You hear them a lot, but, I don't know. It's almost like a thing in my head where I guess they haven't been as invasive down here in Florida and the Georgia, South Carolina as bad as they've been in the last 15, 18 years. And that's just something. When you did hear one, you were thinking, that gobbler, why am I going to imitate a predator right, you know, 100 yards from him?
Yeah.
Whereas when you go north and west, and you hear a lot more coyotes, and they will gobble. Miriam's love gobbling at coyotes. So anyways, I'm getting long-winded. Go to your locators, try to provoke the heck out of one. You do fly up cackles, maybe yelp real loud once or twice, you know, as you're waiting towards that magic hour to get one to go. Because all you need him to gobble is one dang time, and you at least know he's there.
Yep. All right. Well, that's a great conversation today. I actually learned a lot, which is at least one person did today. And that's awesome. And that's why I do this. So real quick, if people want to find more information about you, your calling styles and things like that, mm-hmm. Where should we send them?
Well, first off, go to YouTube and type in Hunt Quest with Scott Ellis. That's my show. And it has mainly turkey hunting. There's some deer hunts, some duck hunts, a few different hog hunts and stuff, but it's more predominantly turkey and tons of tips, calling tips, situational tips, tactics, etc. Outside of that, I have a Facebook fan/business page. It's Hunt Quest with Scott Ellis. It's my business/fan page. Instagram, Scott_C, middle initial underscore Ellis. TikTok, Scott_C_Ellis. That's my TikTok. I'm doing a lot of fun stuff on TikTok. I'm kind of enjoying the heck out of TikTok, actually. It's the Antichrist as far as social media goes, I think. But I'm having fun with it and getting a lot of engagement with people. And I think that pretty much covers it. Check out Woodhaven Custom Calls. Google it, woodhavencustomcalls.com, Apex Ammunition. I'm sure a lot of Mossy Oak users out there already. But yeah, check them out. Check out my social platforms. Right. And thanks for having me on, man. I could talk all night long, and you probably got stuff to do as I have to do.
I got it. My wife is texting me right now saying, we got to go. So
there you go, brother. Well, I've enjoyed it. Have me on anytime, and we'll talk turkey, my friend. Thanks, Dan.
All right. Thank you very much.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. Stop waiting around for the perfect candidate. Instead, use Indeed Sponsored Jobs to find the right people with the right skills fast. It's a simple way to make sure your listing is the first candidate see. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs have 4 times more applicants than non-sponsored jobs. So go build your dream team today with Indeed. Get a $75 sponsored job credit at Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.